So 14 years of being a teacher, I do two things all the time on a Thanksgiving, Wednesday before Thanksgiving. One is to thank people for showing up for a class that's after 3 o'clock on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. I mean, academia survives on people not having a life, and I'm so happy that you guys don't have any lives. The second is a more recent thing. I put up that slide. Okay. Agenda for today's class is a bit more on deterministic planning and heuristics, and also an introduction to planning under uncertainty and partial observability. That's the real agenda. That's the direct agenda. The hidden agenda for today's class is really mostly have fun messing with your minds and see if you like it. And if you do, I encourage you to come and talk to me about research in this area. You know, Vaughn says some of you are really smart. I won't tell you who he says is smart, but yeah, if you like this stuff, come back and talk to me. I have opportunities for undergraduates as well as graduates who are interested in working on these kinds of things. So that's the hidden agenda. Any questions before about the stuff that we may have discussed last time before we continue? Okay, so one of the things that I want to do really is to actually show you, we ended last class by talking about propagating cost information on planning graphs, right? I want to show you that information, and mostly we did that so that we can find the lower cost or least cost plan if the actions have non-uniform action cost, okay? Now it turns out that there is a nice extension to that, which also extends to the normal deterministic planning problem, which you can handle with the same sorts of techniques. So this would be a more general planning problem. So non-uniform cost actions is more general than uniform cost actions. Okay, and then this is even more general, keeping planning still being deterministic. What I'm interested in is I have way too many goals in my goal state. Each of them have some dollar value, some utility value, okay? I have a lot of actions that I can take. They have non-uniform costs. For now, let's assume that they're all in the same units. Everything is in dollars. So actions cost dollars, and the goals give you dollars if you reach those goals. So then the question would be, get me a plan that has the highest dollar value, so the highest utility. You guys have heard about the utility in the beginning when you were talking about decision theoretic agents and so on. So the idea then would be that the best plan may not be the plan that actually reaches all the goals, because the plan that tries to reach all the goals winds up having lower value because it winds up using too many costly actions. Okay, and in particular, in normal planning problems, you might have multiple goals which are conflicting, which are actually conflicting. So you can't really do both. Okay, I mean, you can't both drive to your family and have a good Thanksgiving dinner tomorrow and actually attend this class today. So you have to choose. So there are, when you have a bunch of goals, you wind up having to make selections over the goals, hopefully to maximize your utility, where the utility is the total amount of dollar value you got for the goals minus the total amount of dollar value you lost in doing the action, okay? This is a more interesting optimization-oriented problem rather than the first one we were talking about, which is more satisfying, okay? Now, it still keeps everything else the same. You still have deterministic actions. You still have completely known initial state and all that fun stuff, okay? So how would I solve that kind of a problem? In particular, suppose I'm considering, so as I said, so actions have execution costs, goals have utilities, they're in the same units, and the objective is to find the plan that has the highest net benefit, where net benefit is the cumulative cost of goals that plan achieves minus the cumulative cost of the actions that plan uses. Okay? Now you can do variations on this, and in fact, you can also say things like, look, oftentimes, you don't have an easy way of converting everything into the same unit. Okay, so oftentimes you wind up doing multiple objectives. You want to improve something while not doing too worse on certain other restrictions. Okay, but this is a nice, simple version of that sort of an optimization problem. And if I have this kind of a planning problem, how would I do it? Not changing anything else. So I'll still do progression, okay? And I'll still want to do, again, the big issue would be search guidance. You know, how would I pick, you know, the right set of actions such that the plan that I will wind up ending in is likely to be the best value plan. Okay. Now, always understand the dumb way of doing it so that you can do the better way. Okay. So the good dumb way of doing this would be the following for this problem. Okay. Which is, I have n goals. Okay. Find all the subsets of goals. For each subset of goals, find the best plan for solving it using the cost-based planning that we just talked last time. Okay? And for each best plan, you know what is the, you know, so once you make the goals constant, you know what the best plan. Best plan is the lowest cost plan for achieving that. Okay? For each of these 2n sub-goal sets, 2n goal sets, you have the best plan. Given the best plan, you know the best utility. I mean, the utility of that plan, which is the utility of the goals minus cost of the actions, and pick the one that's the best. Okay, I have given you a solution. Okay, obviously you're not going to do this. This is too costly. There are 2n sub-goals. Okay, but that's the kind of one. You can also see that it's sort of, that's the sort of thing that's involved in doing this. Basically, you have to pick the goals that you need to concentrate on, and then achieve them at the lowest cost possible. That's what you wind up doing. Okay, so then apart from the heuristics that we needed earlier for which branch to take, upfront I want to have a heuristic which tells me which subset of goals is the one that I should concentrate on. Again, if I have a rich uncle, I can always cut down the 2n to 1. Okay, so if there is a way in which I can quickly find out which is the subset which will ultimately wind up having the best net benefit plan, then I just work on that. Okay, so I can convert this problem to a simple classical planning, cost-sensitive planning problem. Now, it turns out that the same idea of planning graph heuristics can be used to provide a solution. This is not necessarily the best solution, but I just want to tell you, here is a way you could solve it. Okay, so the idea is to select the subset of the top-level goals upfront. Before you even start doing the problem, you just decide which are the subset of goals that you're going to work on. And then once you pick that, you never again look back. Those are the only ones that you're going to solve. You know, this is not that far away from reality. If you have way too many things that you need to accomplish, at some point of time, you say, you know, to heck with it. I'm going to do this, this, and this. Okay, and I'll forget about the rest. And then for these three things, I'll let us do it the best way I can. Okay, people don't know optimization. People are very bad in optimization. Okay, and so this is basically a reasonable thing. And so the question, of course, is how do you pick the goal that you're going to concentrate on? Well, I'll say you can use planning graph to do this. You can use the same exact analysis that we were doing last time to do this. Here's my idea. So the idea would be the following. For each goal, act as if that's the only goal that you need to make true. Okay, that's the only goal. So using cost-sensitive planning graph, you know, so you have propagated cost, so you have cost-sensitive planning graph, find the relaxed plan for supporting that goal. Okay, relaxed plan is easy to find. Right, that's just finding a subgraph of the planning graph without any backtracking. And once you find the relaxed plan, you know the cost for the relaxed plan, you know the benefit for the goal, for that's the single goal that you have, and so you know the net benefit of that particular goal. So a better than dumb idea, not as dumb as this, but much better than this, at least computationally, is to sort the goals in terms of their isolated net benefit. Each goal in its own isolated net benefit. So if there are n goals, you would just call n relaxed plan. There's only single planning graph. That's the interesting thing, right? The initial state is still the same. So you just compute one cost-sensitive planning graph, and for each of the n goals, you pick a separate relaxed plan. So you're actually doing very little work. Okay, now, and then, you know, you sort the goals in the order of top to bottom, and, you know, for example, if you're only going to pick top K goals, just pick the top K goals, or pick all the goals that have positive net benefit, for example. Anything which has negative net benefit, get rid of it. This is way better, at least, than this, in the sense this will never terminate because you're going to take too long. Okay. A better idea than what I just said is to consider how goals interact with each other. Okay, it's true that, you know, achieving this goal is 20 units costly. And achieving this goal in isolation is also 20 units costly, but achieving these two goals together may be 21 units costly, or infinite number of units costly. Do you see that? Okay. I mean, if these two goals are negatively interacting, there's no way you can actually satisfy both of them. So you're dead. Or if they're positively interacting, there are actually good ways of solving both of them. So you can win. Okay. So I'll, for now, let's actually act as if the mostly positive interactions are there. And what you would then wind up doing is pick the goal, you know, having done the first thing, pick the goal which has the highest net benefit. Take the relaxed plan that you have for that goal, act as if those are actions that you are already committed to. And for each of the remaining n minus 1 goals, find a relaxed plan for supporting each of those goals, while considering the actions that you already picked as zero cost. Because you already committed. Once you pick that action, it doesn't matter how many things it is achieving. Right? So if you do that, then in essence what you'll wind up doing is the case where this goal is 20 units, this goal is 20 units, but together they can be done in 21 units. You capture that. So in particular, you will realize that after having picked G1, the residual cost of picking G2 is just one unit. So the residual benefit of picking G2 is whatever is the utility of G2 minus whatever is the little extra cost that you're doing. Okay? So now, just a second. Now, what you would do is you would sort the goals in the order of their residual net. I mean, first one, you pick whatever is the single goal that has the highest net benefit. Okay? The second one onwards, you always sort the goals in the order of highest net residual benefit, estimated, of course. You're estimating in terms of relaxed plan. Okay? In the context of the goals that you've already picked and the actions that you've already picked. More than the goals, the actions that you've already picked. Okay? Simple idea. And when you do this, you now pick the, you know, the one which, it's possible that in isolation, you know, here is G1, which is 20 units costly. In isolation, G2 is 20 units costly. G3 is 15 units costly. So in isolation, you would have picked this and this. But together, these two are much better because these two can be achieved in 21 units, whereas these two might require 35 units of action. Okay? Now, so this notion of what is the marginal extra cost that I need to, you know, incur and what's my extra utility? That's a nice idea. And you do this all the time. You know, I mean, as long as I'm going all the way to some place, I can also do this other thing there. As long as I'm going to, you know, a grocery store, then picking up one more item isn't really going to cost me more. And that setupness basically can be handled in terms of biasing the relaxed plan extraction such that it counts the actions that have already been picked as having zero cost. Okay? That's it. And in fact, this is a pretty reasonable idea. And one of the, I mean, for this problem, currently, the best approaches wind up using an idea like this. Now, this doesn't yet take into account negative interactions, but then I actually sort of pushed negative interactions under the table last class too. I'll say a little bit about it today, but mostly we didn't talk too much about negative interactions. Those of you who actually read the textbook know about mutual exclusions, and that's basically the way you consider negative interactions between goals. But I'll say something about them today. There was a question.
That means the path we've chosen for one goal, we are using step less than the goal state, we are using that path again and again for choosing other goals. That means the actions that we have taken to reach that goal, if they should be reutilized again and again.
Not just that goal, the entire plan. I'm talking about the relaxed plan. So to support a goal, a relaxed plan would wind up, so if I have one goal, you know, there are some number of actions in the last level. One of them would be picked. But the moment that action is picked, I have to work on its precondition, which will introduce some other actions, which will introduce some other actions. Now, in supporting the second goal, it may well be that the second goal requires a separate action at the first level, but then that action winds up having a lot of the same preconditions the first action had. And so the rest of it is picked up. Do you see what I'm saying? So there is any overlap between what you're really asking for is, if I'm already doing one thing, the other thing, is it really costly? Okay, and if it's not, then I would like to do that too, you know, because it's just, you know, nickel difference, and I can get much bigger glass of Coke. So that's basically the residual analysis, residual utility analysis. Okay, the reason I brought this up is it's a different problem, and yet everything that we just talked about last class just carries over. All I did was realize that, you know, I have to pick up goals up front, and then how to pick up the goals, again use a heuristic, planning graph based heuristic, and then, you know, note this idea of residual relaxed plan, biased relaxed plan. Okay. So that's actually one of the nice things about this whole notion of planning graph based heuristics. There are like 10,000 variations of them. You can, you know, propagate different kinds of information on them. You can use them under different different conditions to provide heuristic information. Okay, but the main ideas are this: the fact that planning graph ultimately provides reachability information, and it's a cheaper way of providing reachability information than by doing the entire progression search tree. Okay. Here is one other easy thing to get you to understand, again, given all the stuff that you have done. So I'm now doing what the problem is asking me to do, which is, given all the stuff that you already spent last class, you know, what are the other little things that I can make you understand without having to re-explain lots more extra things, okay? So you understand planning graph, and so I could tell you the notion of this thing, for example. This whole planning problem is called partial satisfaction or oversubscription planning. The idea is you have expanded the notion of satisfaction of goal to include that you don't have to satisfy all the goals. You can actually satisfy just some of the goals. The important issue is we have the higher utility. Now notice that this is not the most general of these problems. In fact, one of the interesting issues would be sometimes I have a goal which supports degree of satisfaction. So in fact, my goal is get a lot of money. Okay, get a lot of money, get $10,000 has some utility, you know, $20,000 has some other utility. So the question is, I need to decide what is it that I'm trying to achieve. Okay, it's related to this idea, and in fact, there are variations of the same sorts of techniques which can also apply for when you have what are basically continuous goals, you know, where you get to decide what is the level of, what is the degree of satisfaction that you can provide to that. Here we are deciding whether to pick the goal at all or not. But then in the other case, you can also pick the goal and do it 20%, 100%, whatever. Okay, that's again a variation of it. One other thing that you can easily understand given all the stuff that you know is, so you have this planning graph that we looked at last time, right? So you have a planning graph like this, okay? And now suppose I'm trying to support goals G1, G2, G3, G4, right? A relaxed plan, which we have been talking about all along, okay? Again, ignore the curvy lines for now, okay? A relaxed plan essentially involves picking actions that will support each of the goals. In this case, the problem is simple. There's exactly one action that supports each of the goals. So you wind up picking all those actions. And as soon as you pick all those actions, all the preconditions become goals at this level, okay? And then you wind up picking, you know, bunch of actions. No, actually, you know, you have to continue. So in this case, so I would wind up probably picking, say, A5 for this, then A6 for this, and then what else? A7 for P3, and A8 for P4, and so on. If it was a relaxed plan, we would have just continued like this until you pick A8 for A3, A10 for P5, and A10 will also pick, you know, support P6, you're done. So your relaxed plan would be that structure, and my actions will be A5, A6, A7, A8, A9, A10, and then those. And you count the actions or add up their costs or whatever, which is your relaxed plan idea. Now, as long as you're searching on this graph to find relaxed plans, why can't we search on the same graph to find real plans? What's making these guys relaxed? Okay, you know, relaxed plan essentially doesn't solve the problem. It solves an abstraction of the problem. We said this earlier. But the real question is, what abstraction is it solving? What goes wrong if I try to actually run this as the problem, run this as the solution, run this as my plan? Well, what goes wrong is, you know, for now assume that whenever I put these links, these curvy lines, assume that those two actions cannot be done together. Now, how will you know this? Given an action, given a pair of actions, would you ever be able to tell just those actions cannot be done together? Well, that's not that hard. Suppose action A1 requires P1 and gives, you know, E1. Action A2 requires not E1 and gives not P1, something like that. So if one action kills the preconditions of the other action or the effects of the other action, then they cannot get along well. They cannot get along well. You guys know the operating systems. You guys taken an operating systems, presumably, right? So this notion of serializing processes, when can you sequence a couple of processes? When they don't interact. Okay, when they don't interact, you know, it doesn't matter what order the processes get done on, the eventual answer would be the same. And I'm saying the same thing. When the two actions don't interact, the order in which they actually get done will not change their effect on the plan. Whereas if they interact, then depending on the order in which they do them, you wind up having wrong answer. Okay, so, I mean, basically, suppose I have a situation where A1 gives E1 and A2 gives E2. I need both E1 and E2. Okay, and then A2 also deletes E1. Now, all of a sudden, I can't say they can be done in parallel. Because if I do it, A1 first, eat A2 next, I am dead. If I do A2 first, A1 next, I'm okay. But the point is, if I have n such actions, there are n factorial permutations. Some might be working, some might not be working. And you don't want to mess around with, you know, which one is going to work in the end. You're better off keeping actions parallel only if they actually can be done in any which order. And this is very connected to the notions of process serializability in operating systems, and the notion of transaction serializability in databases. Okay? And in fact, some of the techniques, I don't know who copied from whom, but some of the techniques are the same, the notions of, you know, interaction. So the simplest idea that you can have is a pair of actions interact if the preconditions and effects of one action are inconsistent with the preconditions and effects of the other action. So if one guy is killing what some other guy is giving or needing, then it's interacting. And interaction is bidirectional. If one interacts, then that means you can't do them in parallel. How hard is that to check? You look at the actions, you can tell they're interacting or not. Okay? This notion is called static interaction or action interference. So given a pair of actions, you should be able to tell whether they interfere or not. Right? I mean, they don't interfere if they're talking about completely different preconditions and effects, or they're not inconsistent in the values they're giving to those preconditions and effects. Remember, preconditions and effects are state variables with some assignment. Right? Okay. So interference is easy. So you could easily have gone through this particular, you know, this particular set of actions in the domain and could have figured out upfront what pairs are interfering. And all I'm saying is the following. If you have already made the planning graph, and if on top of it you went ahead and marked the pairs of actions that are interfering at any level, if they're interfering, put a line between them. Okay? Now, you have a way of making a plan that will actually execute. In particular, what you do is you do exactly what you did before, look for a relaxed plan, except you say, I have one extra condition. The plan that you pick better not have any pair of actions at any level that are interfering. If you ever find during your search a pair of actions that are interfering, you undo your commitment, you backtrack. Until you find a set of actions that won't interfere. If you don't, that means there is no subgraph of this plan, this graph, which is a solution. In which case, you extend it one more level and do the same thing again. If not, you're done. Okay. So continuing my animation here. So I came up here A8, right? And then at this point, if I actually have my interferences marked, I would have seen that A8 is inconsistent with, you know, another thing, A6, that I have already committed to in my current plan. Right? So I need to backtrack. Now, normal backtracking will just do chronological backtracking. If something goes wrong, undo everything that you did until you have extra choices and start going that direction. So you undo, P4 is being supported by A8 decision. Then you also undo, so now as soon as you undo that, this problem has gone. So you say, well, P4 can be supported by A9, that's okay. Now what happens? Well, there's another problem. You know, A9 and A5 are interfering according to this picture. So then you undo that. Now there is nothing else you can undo at this level. So you say, you know, you are above me, so I'll kill you. So P3 is the last other guy that I did. Chronological backtracking is the dumb way of doing backtracking. It's easy but dumb. You know, so you say, well, you are the guy before me, and you know, I'm not happy here, so I'll undo you too. So P3 is undone. Doesn't help. Okay, so you go up and undo P2. Now P2, and when you undid P3, actually, it so happened that there was no other action. If there were actions, chronological backtracking would have tried all of those too. And you would all be sitting in the background and thinking, oh, what a stupid search. But, you know, you are not there doing the search. So, no, search algorithm is doing. Okay, in this case, I wrote a picture, so I made it simple enough that P3 doesn't have any other solution. So even though it undid an irrelevant decision, it went, there's nothing else it could do. It had to go back and do the other previous one, where there is a solution, where there is another choice for P2, which is A11. Now I pick that, and if I pick that, I'm okay. Now I pick for P3 A7. Now I have another problem. Okay, and then, you know, I keep doing this. Now in this particular case, there is no solution anymore. Okay, I could have been nicer to you, and I would have made sure that if this last one wasn't an interference, I would have found a solution. The issue that I'm bringing up is, A, as soon as you throw in the interferences, which you can do so darn easily, and if you start doing backtracking on the relaxed plan construction, then you actually don't get relaxed plan, you get the real plan. Okay, originally, the whole idea of planning graph was invented by this guy called Avrim Blum, who is a theoretician who never took an AI course in his entire life, you know, and saw other people mucking around with planning, and he said, why can't I solve it in some completely crazy way? And, you know, he essentially tried to solve it using max flow min cut problems, and then didn't work because max flow turns out to be actually a polynomial problem, planning isn't. So then he messed around with it and came up with an idea which involves growing the planning graph and repeatedly searching for subgraphs of it, exactly the way I showed you. Okay, when graph plan came around in 1995, that's when things started really changing. Until then, you know, the scalability was pretty bad. And as soon as graph plan came around, scalability just was much better. So in fact, there's a beautiful animation of this, which I unfortunately didn't load here. So if you have a PostScript interpreter, this guy would show a PostScript interpreter going through a large enough planning graph. So it will start from here, make a little subgraph, try to go forward, come back, try to go forward, come back, try to go forward, and then in about 3 seconds, it completes the plan, which is 14 steps long. And then he puts a footnote saying, most PostScript interpreters take longer time to display this than my planner takes to solve the actual problem, which is a beautiful thing to be able to say. Okay. So the first time when graph plan came along, you know, without pretty much, you got as far as you can get. Okay. I should mention that graph plan does everything that I said, and one little more thing, which is when there are interferences here, so basically the problem is the interferences may actually wind up being, so you may be making a subgraph and after so many layers down you find some actions wind up interfering, and so you have to undo everything backwards. One of the nice things in search, if you could do it, is try to find out what would be failing eventually and make it clear upfront. So the whole notion of mutual exclusion propagation is essentially trying to propagate interference relations over the planning graph data structure. So the simplest way is the following. If A1 is interfering with A2, and A1 is the only guy who is giving P1, A2 is the only guy who is giving P2, then at this level P1 and P2 cannot be done together. So the only guys who can give P1 and P2 cannot get along well with each other. And if there is an action A4 which requires P1 as one of its preconditions, and there is another action which requires P2 as one of its preconditions, even though P1 and P2 are not inconsistent with each other normally, since they are mutually exclusive here, these guys are mutually exclusive. This is what is mutual exclusion propagation. There are rules, you can read it up in the book. So these are the simple rules, very simple rules. So the idea is, one idea is to propagate, you know, the interferences are a special class of mutual exclusion, the simplest kind of mutual exclusion. And then you can propagate interferences and you get more interferences. So all of these are generally just called mutual exclusion. Okay? And so all I'm saying is, first propagate interference information from action level to the next proposition level. And when you get interference information at the proposition level, then propagate it to the action level, and so on. And if you do this, then in essence, things that you would have found hard way much later, you would find faster during search. And have you guys done constraint propagation, constraint satisfaction problems? Okay, so there is an obvious way of understanding this in the context of CSP, but if you haven't done it, forget about that. So you do some sort of a pre-processing upfront for the entire problem by processing mutual exclusion, and then you do search, and that winds up improving the overall performance. And as long as I'm talking about mutual exclusion, look at a couple more examples. So suppose I have A1 and A2 are interfering, and then A3 is also giving P1. Okay, and A4 is also giving P2. And A3 and A4 are interfering. Can I now, first of all, there's no A4. A3 is giving P1. Now is P1 and P2 interfering? It's true that one way of achieving P1 is inconsistent with one way of achieving P2. But there's another way of achieving P1 which is not inconsistent. As long as there exists one way of achieving both of these, you're okay. So there is no interference. Okay? So when you propagate interference from actions to propositions, you actually have to check that every way of achieving one goal is inconsistent with every way of achieving the other goal. Only then are you sworn enemies. My son, talks about we are arch enemies in classes, and he's only 9 years old. And so these propositions are arch enemies only if every one way of supporting P1 winds up interfering with every one way of supporting P2. So as an example, if I now have A4 which supports P2, and A3 and A4 are interfering, are mutually exclusive, whichever, it doesn't matter. Both are same. In the beginning, you start with the static interference relations and call them mutual exclusions. And then you get more of them by this reasoning. Okay, so now if A3 and A4 are interfering, A1 and A2 are interfering, is now P1 and P2 interfering? Yes, no, maybe what? No. Because there are two guys here, there better be four mutual exclusion relations before you can say these are mutually exclusive. So you're very careful. And it's not that hard, in actually propagating. So from actions to propositions, you have to consider all disjunctions. And every disjunction is dead. Then every way of achieving both of these is dead. So actually, either A1, A2 or A1, A4 or A3, A2 or A3, A4 are the ways in which you can support P1, P2. If all of them are mutually exclusive, then P1, P2 are mutually exclusive. So that's from actions to propositions. That's right. Now, from propositions to actions is simpler. Okay, suppose A4 has multiple preconditions, P1 double dash. A5 has multiple other preconditions too. Okay, P2 double dash. These guys are not interfering with these guys. Just this guy and this guy can't get along. These guys are dead. If one of these guys' preconditions is interfering with one of these guys' preconditions, then they can't be done together. Right? It's a beautiful idea that here this is like a disjunctive reasoning, here it's a conjunctive reasoning. And that's all Scarflan does. That's the whole deal about mutual exclusion. Okay? And if you also propagate the mutual exclusion information on the planning graph, then of course, you know, graph plan would work whether you had mutual exclusion or not. As long as you had just static interferences, you know, graph plan would do a lot of backtracking and find the plan. It, you know, the worst thing a planner can do is give you a plan and say, I think it may be a plan. That's no good. You know, I mean, you want things when out of the box, they better be sound. If not optimal, if not complete, at least be, you know, sound. Okay? And so graph plan is sound, because if it gives you a plan, it will be sound. And if you do mutual exclusion, it's only icing on the cake. It does it faster. Okay? Now, having said this, I'll go back and say, well, if you were doing mutual exclusion on the planning graph to support graph plan, why can't I do the same mutual exclusion on the planning graph to support heuristic computation? Yeah, I can do it too. In fact, remember the notion of level-based heuristics? How did we define the level-based heuristics? We said first level, where if I'm looking for the H lev of P and Q, you will look for the first level where P and Q are present. The index of the first level where P and Q are present. All I will do when I have mutual exclusion is find the index of the first level where P and Q are present, and they are not marked mutually exclusive. One of that actually brings in an interesting point, which is it's possible for two things to be mutually exclusive in one level but become not mutually exclusive in another level. Mutual exclusion keeps reducing as you go forward. It never increases. Okay? So, and that's the way, and if you do that, then in essence you have taken negative interactions into account in computing the heuristic value. And that actually winds up being more informative than just taking positive interactions. Okay? Now, to kind of put it all back into one sentence, originally GraphPlan came along and it was doing this search on this particular structure. And now, in fact, nobody does graph plan oriented search, because the stuff that I told you last class is faster than graph plan, hard as it is to believe. Way faster than graph plan. Okay? So using the planning graph as the basis for heuristics winds up being better than using the planning graph to search for plans directly. So the graph plan guy came up with the idea graph plan, where there's a subroutine data structure called plan graph, and his real claim to fame is not graph plan the algorithm, but plan graph the data structure. That is infinitely malleable. You can change it to do cost propagation, you can change it to do mutex propagation, and you can use it in the heuristic side rather than in the actual search side. And it's actually faster. Okay? So that's part of the reason why the textbook chapter is written in the order I told you, which is first planning graph and then graph plan, even though chronologically first graph plan and then planning graph. Okay. Okay. So I'll stop with the discussion of deterministic planning with that. You know, there are a lot more things that one can be doing, but I want to kind of talk at least at some introductory level on the kinds of issues that will come in doing planning under uncertainty and incomplete information. Remember in the very beginning class I had this set of all, you know, possible complications, and I picked the one with the least complicated version. That's the one I've been mucking around with all this while, mostly. Okay. And now what I want to do is bring in some of the additional complications back, and there are lots of things I can bring back, but I just want to talk to you about the issues involved in handling uncertainty and incomplete information. Okay, these wind up being connected, and partly what I want to do is kind of stretch your minds to see the interactions between uncertainty and incomplete information and how to do plan. Okay, I may or may not be able to give you actual algorithms. The algorithms are there in the slides, but I'm sure at some point of time you want to be able to get in time for Thanksgiving dinner, and so we may have to stop at some point of time. At least I want to get you the general ideas, the interesting, you know, ideas that's out there. Okay, so the main problem in planning under uncertainty and incomplete information is following. Given an incomplete initial state, when I say an incomplete initial state, what do I mean? That means I don't know which of the actual world states I am in. Okay, suppose I have k state variables. There are 2 power k possible world states. Complete incompleteness means I have no clue where I am. I just have no clue. Okay, so I could be in one of the 2 power k states. And I still have to reach a particular goal state. Now this is not as bad as it sounds. I mean, this is not as outlandish as it sounds. You know, that's the worst possible incompleteness. Sometimes of the k variables that define a state, you may be knowing the values of k minus one of them and don't know the values of the last one, which means you are in one of 2 possible states. Either the last variable is true or last variable false. Those are 2 different states. So incomplete means really you are in one of a possibly large set of initial states, complete initial states, and a goal state. And we know that goal state from the beginning was a set of states. It was never a single state. Even in the good old days, in deterministic planning, goal state is a set of states. If you have a set of states for the goal state, that's a good thing. If you have a set of states for the initial state, that's a bad thing. And you better understand that. If you have a set of states for the goal state, that means you are easy to please. If you have a set of states for your initial states, you are clueless. You don't know where you are. And, you know, that's one is a bad thing, one is a good thing. Okay. So incomplete initial state and a goal state and a set of actions with possibly uncertain effects. Okay, so a normal action when applied to a state, a deterministic action, when I say normal I mean deterministic action, when you apply it to a state, it takes you to another state, a single state, that's it, and if it's applicable. If it's not applicable, then it's not defined. An uncertain action when applied to a state takes you to a set of states. The more uncertain the action, the bigger the set of states it takes you. Okay, now actually I'm sort of making you not think of probabilities involved there. In fact, the usual idea would be a more interesting way of thinking of uncertain actions is it takes a state to a set of states with a distribution of these states, saying you are most likely to be in this state with 0.7 probability, this one with 0.2, these rest with 0.1 divided by whatever their number. That's a distribution. So if you have probability information, really an action takes you to a state distribution. For now, we'll ignore probabilities. And so it just takes you to a set of states. So I don't know the distribution. So it's called non-deterministic uncertainty. Okay. So if you have a set of those actions, and then also a set of sensing actions. Now what is a sensing action? Sensing action tells you some whether or not certain facts are true in your current incomplete state. So you have, let's say, you know all the values of the first k minus 1 variables and you don't know the value of the kth variable. There may be a sensing action whose only purpose in life is to do some test, and it will come red if kth variable is true and blue if the kth variable is false. And if you do that sensing action, then you have eliminated the uncertainty based on what it says. Okay. Normally you need sensing actions too, because there are plans sometimes only with sensing actions. For example, in medical scenarios, you may or may not be suffering from a debilitating disease, and I have this particular medicine which will kill you if you don't have that disease, but will make you live a little longer if you do have that disease. And if I don't sense whether or not you have the disease and I just give you the medicine, then, you know, I might get sued. Okay, so I have to sense, I have to do some extra tests like poking you and getting some blood and looking it under the microscope to see whether, you know, what's the probability that you're actually suffering from this disease. So that's what sensing actions do. Now, normally, pure sensing actions do not have any effect on the actual state. The fact that you found out that the missing variable is actually true doesn't change anything in the world. It just changes your head. Right? So a pure causative action, normal actions are called causative actions. Okay, that they actually change the world, nothing else. They just change the world. Okay, a sensing action gives you knowledge about the world. And a pure sensing action only gives you knowledge about certain state variables, nothing more. But really, in the world that you live in, there are no such thing as pure sensing actions. You know, when doctors poke you to get blood and all that stuff, the tests might sometimes be harder than, you know, kind of suffering through the disease. Okay? because the sensing actions do have causative effects too. Okay, that's even worst case. So a set of sensing actions that may also have causative effects. This is your general scenario. Okay, so you have a set of, you don't know where exactly you are. You want to reach the goal, and you have a bunch of actions which are not actually particularly deterministic, and you have also a set of sensing actions, which is actually good for you. You want to reach the goal state. This is what you're trying to do. How would you do it? Turns out this is the algorithm. That's algorithm. And the rest of specific planners just instantiate this algorithm in different ways. It's not, doesn't look like an algorithm, but it's basically, you know, the insight behind how to solve this problem. You do two things. Until you reach the goal state, okay, you always knew you have to progress towards the goal. Do things to progress towards the goal. That you knew already. For that is true for classical planning. You know. One other thing that you may also want to do is reduce uncertainty in the current state. Because it's easier to get where you want to go if you have a clue as to where you are. It's not required. Sometimes without knowing where you are, you can still get to where you want to go. Okay? But reducing the uncertainty sometimes helps. Okay? Now, you sort of know how to make progress towards goal, because that's what deterministic planning told you. You know, this issue of what our actions are giving, what condition effects, and then, you know, how far are those effects from the goal state, reachability analysis. You sort of know. The question is, how do you reduce uncertainty in the current state that you are in? It turns out there are two ways of doing it. One is you do just action, normal causative actions. They, surprisingly enough, when you act, you can reduce your uncertainty. How many of you are surprised about this? That just by acting, not sensing, just by acting, you can reduce the uncertainty in the world. You don't know whether Iraq has weapons of mass destruction or not. Now we know. You know, a couple of years back, you know, if you could have sensed, you know, send this Barodi guy or whoever, or, you know, to keep on sensing, he would have told you whether or not they had. But we did not want to sense. We wanted to take causative action, and we have reduced the uncertainty in the world. I mean, if you take George Bush's words, the world is a much more deterministic, better, happier place. Okay? Right? And if you don't like that analogy, this is the canonical example of these kinds of domains. You know, this is some of the toilet humor. You know, just as you have blocks world, we now have toilet world. So you go into a small toilet, and you find suddenly there are two packages, equal in all respects, identical looking. One of them has a bomb. One of them has a bomb. You don't know which one. Okay, and you don't have any sensing actions. Okay, and it turns out that you can defuse the bomb by flushing the darn thing. Okay, flush anything. I mean, that's the usual way people deal with the problem, right? So the question is, would you guys survive in given such a, you know, in such a situation? Would you be able to survive? Can you defuse the bomb? Yeah, of course. Just flush the both the suckers. If you don't know this, then you probably wouldn't have made it up to this class. You know, you are doing this all the time in your life. You're doing actions to reduce uncertainty all your life. Okay, just by flushing both, which are causative actions, you established certainty, and you actually, from that certainty, you actually established also goal in this particular case. You have to survive before succeeding, and you survive in this particular case. Okay. Now, if you had a sensing action which basically has, you know, there is like a, you know, this is one of these great bathrooms, and there is like, you know, funny looking meter, and then you can put it on this, and kind of infrared radiation, etc., you can figure out which one might have something in it, and then, you know, figure out which one has actually the bomb. How would you do the problem? You may still want to flush both of them. Who the heck cares with, you know, sensing? Okay, in this particular case, you may want to just ignore sensing actions. I mean, in Iraq, we ignore sensing actions, and here too, we can ignore sensing actions. Sometimes the reason you are forced to do sensing is because without sensing, there is no plan. In the doctor case that I told you, Without sensing, the patient won't live, and not patient living is not a good condition, you know, mostly. Okay? So you need to sense. The only plan which takes you to the goal state there required sensing. When there are both sensing and non-sensing plans, in fact, there is a better name as well as a worse name for dealing with problems under uncertainty without sensing. The better name is conformant planning. Looks nice. The worst name is nonsense planning. Okay. And in fact, there was this one time when I was reviewing a paper with somebody else from Canada. It turns out, I didn't know at that time who the other reviewer was. And you know, when you review papers, you don't know who the author is, and you oftentimes don't even know who the other reviewers are. And you know, this was a paper on conformant planning, and I wrote a review, and then after we write the review, you get to see the other people's reviews, and then we discuss before we come to a decision. And then I see the second guy's review, and he starts by saying, this nonsense planning, blah, 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 blah. And somehow I couldn't take it in a good way. And I said, if I can't take it in a good way, probably author would feel bad too. And so I thought maybe this guy is from some Europe or something and doesn't realize that nonsense has a bad connotation. And so I sent a mail, and then it turns out this guy is a guy sitting in Canada. He just wanted to, you know, basically make fun of this guy. You know, saying, why would you ever want to do nonsense planning, I mean, no sensing planning, when you can do sensing? That's his view. Okay. But anyway, it's a good way of remembering that sometimes there is a no sense, I mean, an absolution without sensing, as well as a solution with sensing, and the question as to which one would you pick depends on your cost metrics. Your doctors are doing it to you all the time. Okay, I mean, what's the stupid idea of giving antibiotics the moment you go to the doctor's office? That's basically, I'm too busy trying to figure out which is a viral infection or a bacterial infection, and I know that you are likely to sue me if I don't give you antibiotics, so I'll just give you antibiotics. There are good sensing actions to find out whether you need antibiotics or not, but we won't do it. It's too costly. Okay? So that's kind of the general level. You may have sensing as well as non-sensing plans, and you may pick one. And in some other cases, there may only be sensing plans, and you have to do sensing. And it's a continuum. You can do plans which have more sensing actions or less sensing actions. If you're a really rich person, they'll do more tests on you. If you're a poor student, they'll just, you know, push the needle first and then, you know, let you live for a while. Okay? So that's basically your approach for reducing. I mean, this is the top level idea of how planning is done under uncertainty and incomplete information. Now here's the interesting thing. I mean, there are all sorts of neat variations, and you know, in the time that we have remaining, I'll try to go through some of the neat variations and talk about some representational issues. So for example, till now I didn't actually specifically say what is the state representation when you have uncertainty. I did say it. I basically was saying you could have state variables, except some of the state variables' values are not known. Previously in deterministic planning, an initial state is a complete assignment of values over all the state variables, whereas the goal state is a normal logical formula, which may be consistent with multiple complete assignments. It may have multiple models, whereas the initial state doesn't have a single model from your propositional logic idea. Now, all of a sudden, when you have uncertainty, initial state is a logical formula, goal state is a logical formula. And then progression operation converts logical formulas to logical formulas to logical formulas, and you really need to do entailment check to see that the initial state formula entails the goal formula. In the old days, in the deterministic planning, the entailment was cheaper because entailment between conjunctive formulas is just set membership check. Here now you do real entailment, you know, the stuff that you learned and you may have hated in the, you know, propositional logic and structural logic, you know, entailment, you need to do that. That's the general thing. So, that's basically what this slide is saying. So planning under uncertainty and incomplete information is best seen as a search in the space of belief state. I'll make up a name called belief state. A belief state is just an highfalutin name for set of states, or a general logical formula which has multiple models in terms of state variable assignments. That's it. Okay? And so if you have k variables, you have 2 power k states, and so you have 2 power k belief states. right? K variables, 2 power k states, 2 power 2 power k belief states, because a belief state is a subset of world state. So up front you know that the moment you have uncertainty in the initial state, you have things are not good. Okay, you are going to be searching in the space of belief. Now, so, and then you want to talk about how actions are applied to these belief states. Now, one of the interesting things is when you apply a deterministic action to a belief state, you will get a belief state. You apply a non-deterministic action to a belief state, you will again get a belief state. Okay? And if you apply a sensing action to a belief state, you will get a partition over the belief state. So suppose you have a sensing action, suppose you have a belief state says, I know everything except the values of the fourth variable and the seventh variable. That's my initial belief state. And I do a sensing action which says sense the value of fourth variable. During the planning time, at the time I'm doing planning, all I know is I put the sensing action in the plan. I don't know what the sensing will actually tell me. Right? So at the planning time, all I know is after this action is done, this belief state will be split into one belief state where the fourth variable is true and the seventh variable is still not known, and another belief state where fourth variable is false and the seventh variable is still not known. So sensing actions can also be thought of as belief states. All they do is they partition the belief state. So everything can be thought in terms of belief states now. That's kind of nice. So here are some examples. Now here are like a bunch of special cases, all of which are sort of covered by what I just said, except I want to say specifically that each of them are covered. Some are easier, some are harder than each other, but they're all covered, okay? Suppose you have incomplete initial state. Now notice that, in fact, one of the interesting things I did was I combined partial versus full observability and deterministic versus non-deterministic dynamics. And I'm doing one single lecture for them. Partly because I have no more time, but in fact, because they're very well connected. Okay? So here are all the possibilities. So if I have only incomplete initial state, but I have deterministic actions, bomb in the toilet problem is a classic example of this. When I flush, it gets flushed. By God, it gets flushed. So it's a deterministic action with a deterministic effect. But I don't know which package has the bomb. So I have an incomplete initial state. I can handle that in terms of belief state. The only thing that matters is basically the initial belief state. You can talk about the cardinality of the belief state, which is the number of states consistent with the belief state. Okay? And if it is a single state, if you have no uncertainty, the cardinality of the belief state is 1. If you have complete uncertainty, the cardinality of the belief state is 2 power s, where s is the number of states. I'm sorry. The cardinality of the belief state is S, which is, that means you are one of all the possible states in the world. Okay? So in this kind of example, all I know is the initial belief state has cardinality greater than 1. And I do know that the actions are deterministic, so when you apply them to a state, they give another state, a single state. Which also means if you apply it to a belief state, the way you can apply this action to a belief state is you can apply the action to each of the states in the belief state. So belief state is S1, S2. S1 apply A gives S1 dash. S2 apply A gives S2 dash. So applying A to S1, S2 gives me S1 dash, S2 dash. So I'm still in the space of belief state. It's all closed under belief space. You don't have to get out of it. Okay? But it's a special case, all right, because there are deterministic actions. It's easier in some ways. The other scenario is, now I'll turn it around. Complete initial state, non-deterministic action. Okay, so complete initial state means there is no uncertainty in the initial state. Non-deterministic action means a single state gets mapped to multiple states after the action. That's it. Okay, now, so of course a single belief state will still get mapped to a single belief state. Because, you know, applying an action to a belief state can be best understood as applying that action to every state in that belief state. That's the easiest way to think about it. Okay? So that's your non-deterministic action. Now it turns out that if you have this kind of a domain, can you think of a domain where you have complete initial state but non-deterministic actions?
Gambling?
Yeah, tossing a coin, which is a good case of gambling. Okay, so I know where I am, I'm going to toss a coin, and I don't know whether it will come heads or tails. Now here's the interesting thing. I can convert tossing of a coin, which is complete initial state non-deterministic action, into this problem, which is incomplete initial state deterministic action. So what would I do? I would generate something called guard variable, okay, some random made up variable, okay, and the tossing basically says if this guard variable is true, head will come. Guard variable is false, tails will come. Okay, and now the initial state has guard variable, you just don't know the answer. What is its value? Do you understand this? So having uncertainty in the initial state and having deterministic actions is the same as, I mean, you can convert one into other. You can convert complete initial state uncertain actions into uncertain initial state deterministic action. This is just a syntactic change. I just make up new state variables and throw them into the initial state. This is one reason why they are connected. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we discuss them together. Really, you may think, you know, incompleteness in the initial state and non-deterministic actions are two different things, but you can kind of simulate one with the other. It's a nice idea. Okay, I mean, part of the thing is, you know, you can always say, you know, anything that happens, scientists are stupid. They think, you know, we are unable to predict it. You know, I don't know how to predict it, and they try to look for solutions. And theists, I mean, people who think that everything has an explanation in God particle, think that all we need to know is the God starts, which is an unknown variable, and that just decides everything. For both guys, the world is exactly as uncertain. It's not that just because you believed in God, the world became less uncertain. It's just a question of how you model the uncertainty. Okay. The last one is incomplete initial state non-deterministic actions, which has everything in it. And you can always convert this to, you can always take non-deterministic actions to deterministic actions by making new variables. But that may not be a particularly natural thing to do. Okay. Now, one of the interesting things here, of course, is in this case, the cardinality of the belief state is 1, and when you apply an action to a single state, it takes you to a belief state. And here, both the cardinality is greater than 1, and also the case that action takes you from a state to a belief state. Okay. So the idea of actions taking you from states to set of states is a general idea. It works across the board. Okay. Now, one other thing, this is basically a bunch of slides. This slide basically says a bunch of facts which I already just described to you, I believe. But one thing I want you to think about is actions applied to a belief state can both increase and reduce uncertainty. This should not be surprising to you anymore. Right? I mean, we didn't know before, but after some action, you know with certainty what the world is. So, for example, we don't know in a particular village how many people are awake, how many people are asleep, but, you know, you do a really ear-piercing, siren for about, you know, an hour or so, and you know for sure whether people are awake or not, right? So all the non-deaf people are awake now. The rest are still likely sleeping. Okay. So actions can reduce uncertainty. Actions also increase uncertainty oftentimes. But they can reduce uncertainty. This is one of the reasons why in your algorithm, you say reduce the uncertainty as well as make progress towards the goal state. Here's another interesting thing actually I want to mention about this, which is sometimes you do both. I mean, until now I sort of said either just reducing uncertainty will solve the problem or just making progress will solve the problem. Okay? Sometimes you need both. You wake up in the middle of the night in your friend's home. You know, I would not ask you why you got there. And and then you're trying to find your way to the bathroom. And this guy or girl is sleeping without any lights on. And, you know, remember when you went to sleep, that the place is littered with all sorts of obstacles. Now, how do you get to the bathroom? One thing you do, if you are any, most people do, is try to walk towards the wall and then follow the wall. That's one way of reducing your positional uncertainty. The moment you hit the wall, then you know that, you know, the Helen Keller joke, right? What does Helen Keller's mother do to punish her? She puts her in a cylindrical room where she'll, poor girl will just keep following the walls. Normal rooms, walls have endings and then they lead you out of the room. And so that's one way you reduce your, by the way, the Helen Keller joke was told by Helen Keller, so you can't yell at me. It's politically correct joke because she told it. I'm not making it up on her. So the idea here is there you reduced first your uncertainty. So first go towards the wall and then go from there to wherever you try to go. You do it a lot of times, you know, if you start thinking about it. But this is one example where you definitely are doing it. Let me see what else the last thing I want to say. So this basically is the slide where we are talking about sensing issues. Okay, so as I said, when you do sensing, at plan time, sensing actions partition the belief state. And at the runtime, they tell you, they reduce the uncertainty. They just directly reduce the uncertainty and say you are in this branch. And in terms of the search, in terms of actually finding plans, if you don't have sensing actions, you can just do search in the space of belief states. So there's the initial belief state, there is a goal belief state, actions take you from belief states to belief states, and you just do your A-star search. It's just a larger space because there are 2 power S belief states as against S number of states. It's a harder problem, but by God, if you have an A-star search algorithm lying around, you can make it work on these 2. But if you have sensing actions, it's no longer a star search. Why? Because as soon as you introduce the sensing action during search into your plan, you now know that you have 2 branches. And both branches have to be herded all the way to the goal. And that essentially involves and or search, which presumably you guys didn't do. Okay? But that's the only place where the search algorithm changes. Without sensing, the search algorithm is just a star search. Just a harder search, but a star search. And then let me show you an example of actually conformant planner solving a problem, just so that I can say I did it. Then, okay, let's look at this. Okay, first thing, before I go to this, you guys did planning with non-deterministic actions in this course. When did you do it? Not today. You guys did planning with non-deterministic actions in this class, I think, pretty much. And I'm making an assumption that. Did you guys do game tree search? No? Then we didn't do it. most intro to AI courses wind up doing game tree search. And if you did do game tree search, in essence, you're doing planning with non-determinism. Because when doing things like chess, what you're doing is, chess is a deterministic game for you, but it's a non-deterministic game because of this thing called opponent. You make your move and you made the board to a position after your move. Okay, if you don't want to model your opponent, then if you consider an action to be one action by you and whatever thing that your opponent does that you don't know of, okay, if it's, let's say, an opponent is like in a nature, it's basically you're playing against the nature. Okay, so you make your move, and 3 minutes later, when the opponent's turn is also over, your board basically has some aspects that you can have that you could have predicted because where you put your piece, certain aspects that you couldn't have predicted because the opponent put the pieces that they wanted in some place. So from your point of view, it's actually each move you're making has non-deterministic effects. How do you handle it in game trees? The way you handle non-determinism in game trees is by being overly conservative and say it's important not to lose. Who cares about winning? It's important not to lose. And so even though I know that my opponent can do a lot of things, I will assume that my opponent would do the thing that is most harmful to me. And to the extent I know the entire game, in essence, I have removed the non-determinism by saying, I'll assume my opponent is actually adversarial. Which is why, if you use this strategy to play chess game with your 2-year-old or 3-year-old nephew or niece, the onlookers would think you have gone crazy. Because these kids, most of these kids, and other than the searching for Bobby Fischer kind of kids, have no clue what they're doing, right? And you're still acting as if you're playing with Garry Kasparov by looking at the possibly what worst thing that kid can do. You know, when you're playing with this, you should use a better model. And if you model the non-determinism better, you could have gotten done faster with the game. So in game research, you actually have non-determinism, but by making adversarial assumptions, you actually convert it into deterministic search. And this would have made a lot more sense if you actually did game research, but you know, nevertheless. So here is an example, a very simple example of conformant plan, and we'll go home after that. So here, initial state, M is true, and exactly one of P, Q, and R are true. That's my initial state. Okay, and the goal state, I want G to be true. This looks like any random planning problem. Now here are my actions. The action A1 gives M, and if P is true, it gives K. Now this thing is actually a new thing which I didn't talk about earlier. Previously, actions had preconditions and effect. But one other interesting way of representing actions is to say actions just have preconditions and conditional effects. And a conditional effect will have that effect if that condition was true in the initial state. If not, it won't have it. The advantage of thinking in terms of conditional effects is there is no such thing. And if all the effects of the action are conditional effects, and if it doesn't have any preconditions at all, like in this case, then any action is applicable in any state. It's just that if its conditional effects don't happen, then nothing happens. So it's like the classical view that we talked about last class basically says if you try to do an action where it's not applicable, the world is undefined. That has connotations of nuclear bomb and stuff. Okay. Now, I try to lift a really heavy table. The world doesn't disappear. You know, if the table is not heavy, then I am actually able to lift it. If it is heavy, it was the way it was before. The world hasn't changed. So actually, conditional effects are a nicer way of modeling transitions because, you know, if the preconditions, the conditional effects antecedent is not satisfied, the effect won't happen. If not, it would happen. Right? That's the way the world works for us. You know, when you try an action, normally the world, just because the action didn't have intended effect doesn't necessarily mean that the world disappeared in a puff of smoke. Okay? So anyway, so we'll use these kinds of actions. So M, as soon as you do A, it gives you M and it gives P, it gives K if P was true. Now this conditional effect actually, P must be true before A1 and then K would be true after A1. One is antecedent, one is consequent.
So M
is a condition. These are all M, P, Q, R, G. These are the state variables in this problem. All are Boolean state variables. Okay? A2 gives... Oh, okay, wait. I think I might be thinking that M is the precondition. Because initial state, I have M. So M is the precondition, and Q is true will give me K. Otherwise, it won't give me K. And here, R is true will give me L. And then this one, if K is true, it will give me G. If L is true, this will give me G. Now, if you have these actions, and you don't know whether P is true, Q is true, R is true, can you make a plan for this problem? Late in the day, but you can still make a plan for this problem. Because, you know, if you apply action A1, if P were true, it would have given you K, and you would have been... you would have had K. If not, it wouldn't have had K. If when you apply this action, if Q were true, it would give K. When you apply this action, if R were true, it will give L. By the time you apply these actions, you would either have K or L. Now if you apply these actions, one after other, either K is true, so you got into G, or L is true, so you got into G. So that's your plan. So, you know, A1, A2, A3, then A4, A5. That's your plan. And you can understand that plan in terms of starting from this state, okay, and applying that each of those actions to those states, which will convert one logical formula. I think I have this example here. Okay, that's, I'll leave that there. I will not go through it, but you can go back and look at it. So the initial state logical formula corresponds to that. And when I apply this action, I will get this. When I apply this action, I'll get this formula. Each of these formulas are belief states. Because a belief state is nothing but a logical formula with multiple models, potentially multiple models. Now keep going, and when my current formula, whatever my current formula is, if it entails the goal state, entails in the propositional logic terms, then I'm done. If not, I'm not done. Now notice that in this particular case, I put my logical formula in a particular form. This is the disjunctive normal form. And you know there are two forms, conjunctive and disjunctive normal form. It turns out that when you're doing progression over formulas, if you put the formulas in the disjunctive normal form, it becomes easier because it's closest to what the actions are used to, which is conjunctive, you know, a complete state would be a conjunctive formula. Now you have a disjunction of conjunctive formulas. You apply the action to each of those disjuncts and get new disjuncts here. Okay. And the issue, of course, in terms of heuristics would be how would you find how far a particular state is from the goal state. And for that, again, you would use planning graph heuristics. I won't go into the details. But in essence, what you'll wind up doing is build multiple for a given state, which corresponds to, let's say, 10 real states. At the worst scenario, you can build 10 planning graphs for each of those states. And then use the aggregate information from all those states, all those planning graphs, to figure out the distance. Okay. There are, you know, all I was trying to do, I guess, mostly is to get you to think of how would you handle non-deterministic actions? How would you handle sensing actions? What do they mean in terms of states of the world? You know, it's best to think of them as belief states, and actions will always convert belief states to belief states. And if you think of search in belief states, classical planning also can be thought of as search in belief states, where all belief states just happen to be singleton belief states. A belief state is a set of states, and in classical planning, all belief states are single states. Okay. So by just making that one conceptual leap, then you can pretty much bring in everything else that you know about heuristics, about progression, about regression, back into the game again. Okay. And some of the other interesting thing is this whole notion of reducing uncertainty. It's not just enough to make progress towards the goal, you also want to reduce uncertainty sometimes. That's the only way you can make progress towards goal. And that becomes an important issue when you have uncertainty and incompleteness. And as I said, incompleteness and uncertainty are kind of quite well intertwined. You can convert one to the other. Okay? So I'll stop here.
If I want to incorporate the probability,
So what would happen when you have probabilities is a belief state is really a distribution. That's it. Okay? So which is better, non-determinism or stochastic dynamics? If you have probabilities, what is the size of your search state? So you have k variables, start again, number of states to power k. Number of belief states, non-deterministic belief states, is 2^2 k. If you have probabilistic distribution on the states, how many states are there? Infinite. Because a belief state essentially, if I have a very simple world which has 10 states, S1 up to S10, a belief state is a particular probability distribution over these. how many different probability distributions can you get? Any number of curves, any curve over these states is a different distribution. All you want is all the probabilities add up to 1. And probabilities are unfortunately real numbers, you're dead. Right? Basically, one interesting thing is probabilistic reasoning, the space is infinitely large because the space of distribution is infinitely large. That doesn't necessarily make the problem harder. It just means you don't want to muck around in actually, you know, working in the space of distributions.
But you usually assume you have a distribution, you don't try off possible.
No, no, no. See, that's the interesting thing. So if you are doing, here, look at the interesting contradiction. Mm-hmm. In terms of planning, non-determinism is easier than probabilistic distribution because non-determinism only leads you to 2 power k states for k state variables. Probabilistic reasoning, I mean, if you have distributions, then there are infinite number of states. Okay? But in terms of knowledge, in terms of actual knowledge, which is easier? It's better to have probabilities because that extra knowledge, knowing that I am in one of the 10 states is not as useful as knowing that I am in one of the 10 states and I think actually the probability that I am in the first state is 0.9, second state is 0.999, and the rest all add up to the rest. That is actually much less uncertain than just saying I am in one of the 10 states. And you should not be surprised that a problem with more knowledge is harder than a problem with less knowledge. In a way of thinking, actually, blind people have it easy. I mean, I don't mean to, you know, keep harping on Helen Keller. Because most problems are unsolvable if you don't have eyes. Right? And so you say, I can't solve it. And, you know, you're right. Actually, you can't solve it. Whereas if you have eyes, you have to actually check whether or not you can solve this problem. That's costlier. And that's the reason people want to go back to grade school. They don't want to grow up because as you grow up in some sense, you know, you have more knowledge, but then you also have more, yes, you have more problems that you can solve, but then is that a good thing? Well, it depends on how you look at it. If you want to just not be disturbed when you're watching Seinfeld reruns, then it's better not to have to, you know, deal with, you know, it's better to be able to say, no, I can't solve it, no, I can't solve it. And if you don't have any knowledge, the probability that you are right is very high. Think about it this way. Okay? And of course, you know, when you have probabilistic distribution, you can always throw the probabilistic distribution out and make it into a non-deterministic problem and try to solve it. And what would happen is your performance metric, any reasonable performance metric, would say you are a loser compared to somebody else who's not just using, you know, Seinfeld reasons and actually solving the problem using problem distribution. That's why we wind up not doing it. Otherwise, we'd all be watching that. That's what I think at any rate. Okay? Good. Have a happy Thanksgiving. More donuts. And thank you.